Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, we're going to visit with Vicki Jarrett, the editor of Our State Magazine, who's going to take us around the state based on some stories in Our State Magazine. And the first, Vicki, first of all, welcome. You're so good to do this with us.
Oh, you know, it's my pleasure.
And you know, the only time that I can get the great 30-year man, Ron Stutz, to participate in Who's Talking is when you're on there. And I don't know what's going on there, but I think he's
way
either...
Way to start a rumor there.
Okay. He's a big fan of Vicki Jarrett
Vicki and I have a great relationship.
Yes, we do.
No question.
And I think he likes Our State Magazine as well.
Yes.
And all of us love your taking time out to take us around North Carolina. And first off, today we're going to visit with the North Carolina Symphony because Vicki, how about telling us you're in this issue of the magazine, you've gone crazy about music.
We have gone crazy about music. We have struck up the band, so to speak. We really wanted to just get into the musical heritage we have in this state, and you can't do that without at least talking to some extent about the history and the development of the North Carolina Symphony. It is our symphony. And I think more than in some other states, certainly, this symphony has made itself a part of not just its home turf in Raleigh, but all over the state. As a matter of fact, they've come off the Capital One summer tour where they were in Western North Carolina. They've done all kinds of projects like that throughout the state. So we were just delighted to be able to highlight what's going on with the symphony.
Well, we've been fortunate enough to recruit David Waters from the North Carolina Symphony to join us. And David, we just want you to preach a minute. And what's going on at the Symphony?
Well, I'm happy to, DG, and it's good to be with you. And Vicki, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a great time for the Symphony. Vicki, I think you really understated the case as to how unique this treasure is that we all enjoy in the North Carolina Symphony and the role that it plays throughout the state and the commitment to music education. I've been fortunate to be able to travel around quite a bit and visit with a lot of other orchestras and communities. And I've got to tell you, there just is not another example of an orchestra that is even remotely close to the way that this North Carolina Symphony serves its state. It's really a remarkable story. Actually, that tour that you referenced actually was a Capital Bank.
But
the Capital Bank Blue Skies and Red Earth tour. I mean, it's a perfect example. I mean, here's the orchestra traveling around the far western reaches of the state. And in a single week, this orchestra played in Hickory and Cullowhee, Murphy, Asheville, and Rutherfordton. And I hope I'm not forgetting any communities. We did an education concert as well as in Morganton. I mean, it was just a spectacular example of the North Carolina Symphony bringing the music to the people. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of history, and we were, you know, I suppose your listeners probably know we were founded in 1932, but it was a gentleman and that was Lamar Stringfield, but it was a gentleman by the name of Ben Swaleen, who in the very late 30s took the reins of this orchestra, and together with his wife Maxine Swaleen, really built the orchestra into what it is today. This idea of a truly statewide orchestra.
Well, Maxine Swaleen is one of our heroines. She's one of my girlfriends. I really just love that girl. She's, you know, when she grows up, I might, you know, if something happens to Harriet, I might propose to her. She's only 104 years old.
She's only 104.
And last year, maybe the year before, I did a birthday interview with her on this program. And she had fallen down and hurt herself, but she was lying in the bed, but just as peppery and just as wonderful. What a great story. Y'all are going to honor her, aren't you? Aren't you going to do
there
something?
There are some plans underway to honor her at the time of her 105th birthday,
which is next April, is that correct?
That sounds right to me, and that's happening under the auspices of the University of North Carolina. Of course, there's a very, very deep connection there between the university and the Swaleens. But DG, I had the pleasure of speaking with Maxine on the phone the day after the 104th birthday, and just perky and sharp, and wanting to know what was going on with the orchestra. And I mean, she's just remarkable.
Well, she's got stories to tell, and we'll just have to come back. We'll get all of us together again to celebrate Maxine's 105th birthday. But tell us about what you've got going on in the future, performance-wise, and other plans that you can maybe tell us little secrets about?
Sure, yeah. In terms
about.
Of thinking a little less about the history and looking forward, of course, Grant Llewellyn is with us as our music director, and he has been a real source of pride for the community, and the orchestra loves him, and they're playing real well, and the orchestra is actually growing itself. And this year, one of the things we're looking forward to is introducing three new members of the orchestra. The orchestra is actually expanding. We've grown from 62 players now up to 68. And Karen Galvin and David Kilbride and Christopher Fisher are brand new musicians recruited from around the country to join us this fall. So we're looking forward to them becoming a part of our North Carolina Symphony family. And then in terms of programs, I would not be doing my job if I did not mention our 75th anniversary gala, which takes place this coming September the 15th. That's in Raleigh at Mamandi Concert Hall, but we're bringing in Denise Graves, who must be one of the most magnetic and talented opera singers working today. And she'll be with us for a special gala performance, which is the culmination of all of our 75th anniversary activities. And then, of course, we have our full series in Chapel Hill this year, and a couple of new things to mention. We'll be doing our first rendition of Handel's Messiah and bringing that to Chapel Hill with Grant Llewellyn conducting. And then Gerhard Zimmerman, just the month before, who's our long-time conductor and wrapping up his five-year appointment as conductor laureate, he'll be doing Mahler's Sixth as his farewell concert to Chapel Hill in November. So there's just there's a lot to look forward to. And Chapel Hill, especially since the retransformation of Memorial Hall, Chapel Hill has become an enormously important part of our performance schedule, and we always look forward to getting a chance to go over to Chapel Hill and visit in Memorial Hall, and more often than not, it's a packed audience.
Well, almost always, we're grateful for all that you and your colleagues do, David. May I ask just one real quick question? That one of the challenges, it seems to me, that the symphony has as it fulfills its important mission to go across the state, both educating and performing for, or developing an enthusiasm for wonderful music, is that when you leave Mamandi Hall or you leave Memorial Hall and go out into other performance places, it must be tough as nails to adjust to different conditions. And how does the orchestra do that?
Well, that's one of those topics we don't talk a lot about, it because it really is difficult. And I think one of the things that the general public did, they just don't have any idea how difficult that adjustment is.
I'm married to a musician, and one of the things that I always hear from him is how much the different location, the different humidity, the heat, whatever, how that can have an impact on the
everything
instrument.
Everything is different, and I liken it to a professional painter who's trying to create this masterpiece, and everything sort of looks one way in a certain room, and then all of a sudden you either go outside or you switch rooms, and the lighting's different, the colors look different, and in our case, the sound is different. Right. The way musicians hear each other, everything changes. And so, fortunately, this orchestra is accustomed to that, and so they are much more skilled and adept than many other orchestras at adjusting quickly to new venues and to new acoustic environments.
Well, David, I would say that's one of the real gifts that they give all the people of North Carolina, because so many people don't realize how much goes into trying to make all those different venues work.
Yep, absolutely,
and
right.
The fact that they are willing to do that, and they give these wonderful concerts and such gorgeous, magnificent music, it's just a wonderful present.
Yeah, and a lot of orchestras that are our size, and we're fairly substantial in the scheme of American orchestras, is that most of those orchestras are really city-based. And so when you talk about this orchestra's commitment to statewide service, what you're really talking about are our orchestra musicians' commitment to serving the state. It is a passion of this orchestra. And, there are a lot of communities that we serve that, were it not for the symphony's sometimes annual or every other year appearance in that community, those residents wouldn't have chance to hear a live orchestra. So,
well, David, we're going to have to get you to come back and visit some more. And you're always welcome to come and tell us what you got planned, either for Chapel Hill or the rest of the state.
That sounds
just
great.
We're grateful for what you're doing, for what your wonderful conductor, Grant Llewellyn, is doing, and and for all the planning that goes into those performances that we enjoy so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for giving me the chance to spread the word.
Thanks a lot. Vicki Jarrett, Ron Stutz, and I are talking about different places to go in North Carolina. We're going to take a quick break, and when you come back, we're going to take you to St. Andrews for a little bit of bagpiping, and then back to Chapel Hill for some discussion about our own Cliffhangers and Lorelei's. We'll be right back after the short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ron Stutz and Vicki Jarrett and I are traveling across North Carolina with the help of some of the great writers for Our State magazine. And Vicki, today we're talking a lot about music, and one of your themes has to do with Scottish heritage.
That's right. We really wanted to touch on all the different kind of heritage aspects of music in the state. And, of course, there's lots of different types of music that we enjoy. But one of the things I thought is special to our North Carolina heritage is the bagpipe music, and especially the fact that at St. Andrews College, we have a bagpipe choir band. I'm not quite sure what to call it.
Curriculum.
Both of them, she says. So,
curriculum, yeah.
Ruth put together this wonderful photo story for us, and we have just terrific photos of the band playing together, practicing on the field, some close-ups of the tartans and the pipes and all the different parts of it. It really gives you a feel for what's involved in a bagpipe band such as this.
Well, Vicki, we were pleased that you've recruited Ruth Moose, who's one of the great teachers of writing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a great writer herself of wonderful, wonderful short fiction, and lots of other things. We won't get into Ruth's career, but we're proud that Ruth is writing for Our State. Ruth, tell us about St. Andrews, and tell us about the bagpipes.
Well, it's part of that business of follow your bliss. I love bagpipes, and I think it's my DNA.
are you Scottish or are you Scotch-Irish?
Scottish to the core. My family came over from the Isle of Jura. Oh. Which is off the coast of Scotland. And so I've always loved bagpipes. And I saw an article in probably the News and Observer about the St. Andrews Band winning the Southeastern Pipe Band competition. And it also said they were only one of three places in the country that taught bagpiping. So I just decided to investigate it further and went down and interviewed Bill Caudill, who is Mr. Bagpipes. It's a fascinating story.
Well, who is Bill Caudill?
He is the director of the pipe band at St. Andrews.
Wow. And where did he, is he Scottish or is he just
to the core. Uh-huh. he started when he was 9 years old. He fell in love with bagpipes, and he was in Monroe, North Carolina, and he was lucky enough to be near Charlotte, which had some good bagpipers. His parents took him to lessons in Charlotte. He lived out in the country, so nobody complained when he practiced. And
which I think might be an important aspect to getting into bagpiping.
Ron Stutz is sitting here grinning. I don't know why, whether he's, in addition to all of his other talents, he's a bagpiper too.
No, I don't think so. But, I can imagine that when you're practicing and you don't really know what you're doing yet, it could be a little annoying when you're practicing bagpipes.
Well, it's been compared to, like, killing a cat or skinning a cat or...
Well, it is, Ruth, it is... I mean, I'm like you. I've got all this in my genes, too. And I love it, when I hear it, I want them to send me out. But it is. I mean,
not if you love it. Not if you love it.
Yeah, it's like haggis. It's good if you love
that.
It, or if it's chitlins, it's good if you love it. But man, if you don't, I don't know.
It was really fun to highlight St. Andrews and what Bill is doing there, because they are one of three. This group has won numerous awards. They have played everywhere, and they're just extraordinary. And they also provide, what Ruth was alluding to, is is if you have an interest in learning the bagpipe, here's a place where you can go to do it right here in North Carolina.
And get college credit.
And get college credit.
All right.
How
well,
fun
Ruth,
is that?
You've convinced me. Now, what if I just want to hear one of these bagpipe performances? I guess you could go to the to the Grandfather Mountain for the Gathering of the Clans.
The Highland Games, they play for that. I think they play for weddings. My home church in Albemarle, before I came to University Presbyterian, they have a kirking of the tartans, and everybody comes in carrying their tartans with the bagpiper comes first. So bagpipes are in church. Like I said, parades, the St. Andrews, you know, every occasion they have the pipe band. So it's more prevalent.
The other thing is they practice outside.
Yes.
So if you just want to go get a taste of it, head down there and
head down to Laurinburg.
Head down to Laurinburg.
Right.
Well, that's great. And Ruth, let's you and I plot to figure out a way to get these bagpipers to our little church here in Chapel Hill.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Well, listen, speaking of Chapel Hill, Jimmy Tomlin, Vicki, has written an article, and it's not just about Chapel Hill, but it's about vocal music and cappella groups. And tell us a little bit about that story and see if you can get Jimmy to tell us some more.
Okay. Well, he touched on a lot of things for us. We wanted to kind of capture all the choral music because we were talking early about the North Carolina Symphony, and they're getting ready to do maybe a special performance of Handel's Messiah. We have choral groups all over the state that enjoy getting together, some occasionally, some on a regular basis, and we got Jimmy to really highlight some special groups around the state, including a couple right there in Chapel Hill.
Well, DG, one of the things that was really interesting to me when I started researching this, I found out that there are hundreds of a cappella groups all over the country at different colleges and universities. There's apparently a cappella music is really enjoying kind of a revival right now, and a lot of it is coming through universities across the country, these young kids who have just developed a love for a cappella music. And for those who may not know, and most people probably do, but a cappella means there's no musical accompaniment. And some of the best a cappella groups are right there in Chapel Hill and right down the road in that other city, Durham. but there are four in particular that we highlighted at Chapel Hill. They're the Clefhangers and the Lorelei's. The Clefhangers are an all-male group. The Lorelei's are all women. And then at Duke, you've got the Pitchforks, which is an all-male group, and Out of the Blue, which is an all-female group. And these four groups in particular have won national acclaim. They've all been around for, you know, 20, 25 years. I remember the Clefhangers and the Lorelei's from when I was at Carolina years ago. And
was Ron Stutz?
They had a great reputation back then, and they still do.
Was that before or after Ron Stutz came to WCHL?
Well, it was not that long ago.
Oh, come on.
Well, this is great. I just have to say I was excited, Jimmy, for you to give attention to these great performing groups. And there's something going around in my head that we sort of during my lifetime, we've gotten away from performing for each other. And we've gotten addicted to all of the devices and the sound and the accompaniments and all of the glitz that goes with music performances.
All the high-tech stuff.
Yeah, all the high-tech stuff. Yeah. And that's great. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with it except that it gets you away from the real enjoyment of the human, the human contribution to the music. And these cappella groups, that's all there is to it.
My love for a cappella music goes way back to the 50s for the doo-wop groups and all that kind of thing, singing on the street corner. I mean, there's nothing better than that. And then there's some religious-oriented groups like the Persuasions, who are a great a cappella group, and just terrific music, man. Nothing like the human voice as an instrument.
Yeah, there is no more pure sound than just the human voice alone or the human voice in harmony with other human voices. It's a special sound.
Well, and that's it. With a cappella music, you often have harmonies there that you don't have when you have a lot of instrumentation. The instruments take over some of those layers, but with a cappella, all the voices are doing all those layers in the chord.
Well, it makes me want to go hear these Clefhangers again, and of course the Lorelei's, and there are many opportunities here in Chapel Hill to hear them. And Ruth, you were mentioning about the bagpipe groups being able to travel around, and I think these a cappella groups, and I assume the ones at Duke are looking for performance places as well. So those of us really wherever we live in North Carolina can consider inviting those groups to come perform for us. They enjoy performing.
Absolutely. They do travel. They travel throughout the Southeast, and they've also, all four of these groups in particular, have done a number of recordings that you can buy as well.
And a cappella groups, unlike bagpipers, the acoustics may be a little different depending on the venue, but they can perform just about anywhere.
Mm-hmm. And DG, just to give you an idea of how good these kids are, most of the groups have maybe 15 to 20 singers. So on a given year, they may have just four or five slots to open up when, you know, when members of the group have graduated. And they'll have easily over 100 people auditioning for those spots, and only, you know, three or four or five at the most are going to make it. So the best, you know, they're good singers.
The best of the best in North Carolina.
Right.
Well, gosh.
Sure.
Well, Ruth Moose and Jimmy Tomlin, thank you so much for sharing with us what's going on in North Carolina music-wise, and look forward to having talking to you both again soon.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Vicki Jarrett and Ron Stutz and I are traveling across North Carolina with the help of some of the stories from Our State magazine. And Vicki Jarrett, we've been talking a lot about music. You've got another place close by, or another group that's based close by, and I wonder if you'd tell us about them.
Well, this is a story that Diane brought to my attention, and we kind of came at it from two angles. We talked about it in terms of the man who has sort of been a mentor for this group, as well as the group itself. And it is the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and their mentor is Joe Thompson. And their music type is the old-timey string band sound, and that's another piece of our musical heritage here in North Carolina.
Wow. Well, Diane Silcox Jarrett is the author, and you've persuaded her to come tell us about the Chocolate Drops. What? Tell us all about the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and those of us who live sort of over here in Chapel Hill, Carver area, we missed something, haven't we, by not going over to Durham and hearing this, folks?
Well, you definitely have. They have played in Carver. In fact, I saw them there.
I have had the opportunity to introduce the Chocolate Drops on stage in Chapel Hill and in Carborough. So you know, that's why I'm so enthusiastic. They're really great.
They're just incredible. They're three distinct different personalities and the way they blend together. And I guess I was in awe of them because they're so much younger than me, and they have so much talent, and they're so smart.
Well,
I mean, they have an incredible amount of knowledge about the music they play. I mean, they have not gone about what they're doing half-heartedly at all. And they have definitely studied so much with Joe Thompson. He is.
Tell us about Joe Thompson. He's not all that young.
No, he's 88.
Well, compared to Maxine,
he's about your age. He's about your age, DG.
he's a couple of years younger than I am, but so I say still young, but he's older than those who've learned from him. So tell us about Joe Thompson.
Well, he played a lot of string music back in his day, and in that area right there. And I found out there's different types of string music. I learned all this because I didn't know. And they plays the Piedmont style music. And Justin, a member of the group, is really focused in on that with Joe. I mean, all three of them have. But him and his cousin Odell, they played a lot in the area and kept the music up at social gatherings and picnics and church groups. And then I guess around in the 70s, the music had almost died down. And that was how they entertained each other and gathered in that area was with this type of music. And the Carolina Chocolate Drops, they heard him up in a black string banjo type gathering up at Appalachian State University. And I guess all three individually, since they didn't know each other at that time, just were, you know, in awe of him and, you know, gathered there in Durham and started visiting him.
And so out of that out of the experience in Appalachian, the Durham group gathered, kind of got to know each other and gathered around this sort of senior citizen.
Well, and they had unique training. I mean, they'd come to it from a background that you might not accept. For example, Rhiannon, is that how you say her name? Giddens?
Rhiannon.
Rhiannon, okay. She was a trained opera singer.
Oh, right. You're kidding.
And so she has come to it from the Oberlin Conservatory of Music and has come into string band music. And they each have kind of these varied backgrounds that they have blended together. I just want to make sure we mention that Joe has just received one of the 11 National Heritage Awards that is bestowed by the National Endowment for the Arts just this year.
Wow.
And so he's really been honored. There are two people from North Carolina, and Joe was one of them.
Well, now, Ron Stutz, you mentioned you'd introduce this group, and if you were trying to describe their music as being different or distinctive or something that we would want to hear, you really got excited about it. Why?
Yeah, they're really, really talented musicians, number one, and their enthusiasm for the music and for the performance is just contagious. But I would characterize it as a combination of old-time string band music, bluegrass, blues, just a mixture of all of that, and banjo-heavy, percussion-heavy. I mean, it just really, really neat. And the cool thing is that they are so enthusiastic that they get everybody who's watching them enthusiastic as well. And I can't think of anybody who could sit there and listen to them play for a few minutes without just kind of tapping along with their foot and getting into the music too.
Well, you got me, Diane, Ron, Vicky, got me excited. When is the next time they're going to be here? When can we go hear them play? What a great thing, Diane, that you've done in sharing this with us. We're really grateful.
It was definitely my pleasure, especially when I got to know them. It's like Vicky said, they've come from such, I mean, their musical background. I mean, Justin, he played. It was so funny. He said he was trained classically in violin lessons from age 9 to 13, and then he liked listening to the music, but he didn't like playing it. And I remember him telling me, he said, you know, finally my mother said, if you don't practice, we're not going to, you know, pay for the lessons. And he was like, oh, finally my plan worked.
Much prefer a fiddle to a violin.
Well, Dom,
I mean, he came from out west to come here to play the music. And his, you know, percussion is, you know, I keep saying they're incredible, but they really are. And I think one thing is they're so knowledgeable about what they're doing.
So they, during their performances, they talk a little bit about what the music is,
and
I love it when a musician shares not only the music but also gives me a little hint about what to listen for and why it goes this way, and gives me a little bit, it sort of brings me on the inside of it.
Well, DG, they're playing nearby in just a week or so. They're going to be at the 20th annual Bull Durham Blues Festival.
Great.
So kind of mark that on your calendar. Right. That'll be a chance to hear them.
I'm going
to
do it. And thanks to all of y'all for letting us celebrate the Chocolate Drops and nearby music group that everybody here, I think, except me, has heard. And now I'm going to correct that real soon. Well, Diane, thank you a lot. We're going to take a quick break. And after that, Ron Stutz and Vicky Jarrett and I'll be back to take you to another place in North Carolina. We'll be right back.
Short life of trouble, little girl, for the boy with a broken heart.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, Ron Stutz, and Vicky Jarrett and I are going across North Carolina. And we're doing it sort of with the help of the pages of Our State Magazine, which Vicky Jarrett edits. And one of the things, Vicky, that you do every month is that you note several North Carolina-related books to call to attention to your readers.
That's right.
That's an important part of your book.
Yes, we do a small department. We call it Tar Heel Literature, and we always review two or three, four books from around the state, different types of books, and then we do a section that we call Quick Lit. And one of the ones specifically that we wanted to talk about today was a review we did of a book called Cataloochee by Wayne Caldwell. Excuse me, I'm not saying it right.
Well, we've been able to persuade Wayne Caldwell, who now lives up in Nashville, to join us and to talk about his book. Wayne, we're privileged to have you here for a full program, which is on the web at on the WCHL website, if somebody would like to have a little bit broader discussion about your book. But
that thanks. Is WCHL1360.com.
Oh, thank you very much. A great website. Wayne, tell us about Cataloochee and how you got involved with this book.
Well, Cataloochee is what people call, a sprawling tale, which is, shorthand for long Southern novel. It's set in Haywood County in the western part of the state. It takes place from about 1865 to 1928. This is an area that some people may know as the eastern end of the North Carolina side of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And the book is really the tale of two or three families that settled there. And as the book ends, they're about to get uprooted by the federal government.
Now, why is the federal government getting ready to uproot them?
Well, somebody got the bright idea that we needed to have an Eastern National Park. People in Tennessee and North Carolina had been out west and were really enamored of the Western National Parks. And in the mid-20s, they got to talking up the idea of an Eastern Park, and it just sort of coalesced around the eastern end of Tennessee and the western end of North Carolina. And nobody, of course, asked the people who lived there whether the idea of a national park was a great idea or not. You know how that goes.
It's a great thing for everybody in America and in the world, but except for those folks who got kicked off, got the eminent domain or the threat of eminent domain,
right,
that drove them off. And it always raises the question of property rights and when the government ought to have the power to kick people off of their property so everybody else can enjoy it.
Right. That is not the main focus of Cataloochee. That will be the focus of my next book. But we're leading up to this.
What is the main focus of your book?
The main focus, I think, of the book is people and their relationships with each other and with the land. And that among other things, makes this novel and quite in the mainstream of Southern literature. It also has a dead mule in it, which makes it quite Southern as well.
That's a prerequisite.
Yeah, well, you wanted to be identified when we Googled the dead mule. You wanted to be there. Now, I wish we had more time to talk about this, but I do. We're going to take time for you to describe the leading character of the central character, I guess, mm-hmm. of your novel. Tell us a little bit about this guy starting in 1865.
He is a young man named Ezra Banks who leaves home at age 14, leaves an alcoholic, abusive father, steals his horse, actually, and goes to Asheville, enlists in the Confederate Army. And while he's at the very tag end of the war, he sees an area called Cataloochee, falls in love with it. After the war, he spends some time amassing enough money to buy a farm there. And in 1880, comes into Cataloochee and marries. He's about 30 at that point. He marries a 15-year-old girl named Hannah. And they go on to have a long and, I'll just say, interesting relationship.
Tumultuous? Is that?
Tumultuous would work, yeah. Ezra's what I would call a difficult person. And alcohol tends to get the better of him, too. And he's one of these guys that eventually people look at and say, you know, he needs killing.
we will let the listeners guess whether or not somebody met that need.
There you go.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's in the tradition, I'd argue, of books like Cold Mountain, 13 Moons, the Gap Creek, the other Western North Carolina writers, some of Lee Smith's work, in which not only do you get a good story, but you get this most beautiful descriptive language and a real sympathy for the people involved. And Wayne, I'm looking forward to a growing appreciation, already a great appreciation of this work, but I think we'll watch appreciation for your work grow. But now, now compared to me, you're a young man, but you're not exactly just coming out of Carolina writing your first novel. What took you so long?
Well, it's called life. I was teaching back in the 70s and switched careers in the mid-70s to a family business here in Asheville, the Sluter Furniture Company, and that was about 31 years ago. I started writing seriously when I turned 50, and here we are, 9 years later, and got a novel out.
Life is what happens when you're making other plans.
There you go.
Well, it's a congratulations. You got a great publisher.
Thanks,
a lot
DG.
Of attention and wonderful critical remarks, and thank you for taking time. Will you stay with us? I want to talk about one of the other great things about North Carolina that Vicki Jarrett has introduced to me by way of the pages of Our State Magazine, and that is the old-time schoolhouses. And Vicki, talk to us about some of the treasures of old-time schoolhouses. And Wayne Caldwell, you you grew up in the mountains, and I bet you you've got memories of some of these one-room type schoolhouses that your parents attended. But talk to us, Vicki.
Well, I think that's kind of where my interest in these one-room schoolhouses started, was listening to my mother, especially my mother, talk about her early years and attending a one-room schoolhouse and all the grades being together. And also, both my parents are teachers, so it's not too much of a stretch for me to imagine, some of the inherent difficulties there must have been for teachers just in trying to make all of that work together. And there's just such a nostalgia, I think, associated with this simpler time, although I don't think it was necessarily simple sometimes to make it all happen. So we took an opportunity with this particular issue to highlight some of these wonderful schoolhouses that have been preserved by different groups, and some of them have become museums, some community centers.
Pick out one or two and tell us about them.
Well, of course, one close by to you right there is the Burwell School in Hillsboro, which is not necessarily a one-room schoolhouse in the traditional sense, but it does have many of those aspects, with the grades being together and, just some of the flavor of those early academies. One of the things that I found really interesting in putting together the information to go with these photographs was how the communities would come together and really have this strong desire for some kind of formal education for their children. And so they literally came together to build the building and hire the teacher. Very often it was churches in the community that helped get it started and helped, provide the educational resources. So it's very interesting to see how that progressed and developed. It's really kind of a grassroots approach to education.
It reminds
in the early days
that the state-sponsored scheme of public education is not something that just has been there since Adam and Eve.
That's right. It's a fairly new part of our history.
And that the earlier, like in the Burwell School, which you mentioned up in Hillsboro, the private citizens had to take the lead in developing some of these academies.
That's right.
Well, of course we need to go up to Hillsboro and see that now, but was there one of these that you visited or that you saw pictures of that you just said, everybody in North Carolina ought to see this one?
Well, there are a few of them that I have seen personally. I have been to the Whippoorwill Academy that is way out in Wilkes County, and that is now a museum. I have seen some of the ones locally that are, there's not a lot that you can tell from just visiting them unless you have some information kind of in your back pocket, but one in particular, I'm not sure if we had it in this photo essay, is up in Roxboro, and it's on the grounds of the museum there, and you can go in and take a look. But there's another one right here in Greensboro. As a matter of fact, I believe I mentioned it on our website, which is it's a reproduction of Miss Lena Porter's one-room schoolhouse. And the reason that's interesting is one of her students was a gentleman by the name of Will Porter, who
wow.
went on to be known as O. Henry.
O. Henry.
Yeah.
Well, O. Henry and another great North Carolina writer, Wayne Cowell, whose book we celebrated today, a great place for us to end and to thank Vicki Jarrett for taking us across North Carolina again. And Ryan Stutz and I and Vicki will be back with you sometime soon to talk about the North Carolina that our state tells us about.
It's an O. Henry surprise ending.
There you go. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.